This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. An incident at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility Sunday was caused by an act of nuclear terrorism, according to the country's nuclear chief, Ali Akbar Salehi. According to state TV, adding that Tehran reserves a right to take action against the perpetrators. Earlier Sunday, the spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said that the problem with the electrical distribution grid of the Natanz site had caused an incident. Spokesman said the incident caused no casualties or contamination. The facility, located in the desert in the central province of Isfahan, is the centerpiece of Iran's uranium enrichment program, and it is monitored by inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN nuclear watchdog. China's top disease control official says their vaccine's effectiveness is low, and the government is considering mixing them to get a boost. Chinese vaccines do not have very high protection rates, said the director of China's Centers for Disease Control, Gao Fu, at a conference Saturday in the southwestern city of Chengdu. Beijing has distributed hundreds of millions of doses abroad while trying to promote doubt about the effectiveness of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine made using the previously experimental messenger RNA or mRNA. Australia has abandoned a goal to vaccinate nearly all of its 26 million population by the end of 2021. This follows advice that people under the age of 50 take Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine rather than the AstraZeneca shot. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said in a Facebook post Sunday afternoon, Australia had banked on the AstraZeneca vaccine for the majority of its shots. This is VOA News. This Monday marks the day that millions of people in England are getting their first chance in months for haircuts, casual shopping, and gym sessions as the government takes the next step on its lockdown-lifting roadmap. Nationwide restrictions have been in place in England since early January, and similar rules in the other parts of the UK to suppress a surge in coronavirus infections that swept the country late last year, linked to a more transmissible new variant first identified in southeast England. Britain has had Europe's worst coronavirus outbreak, with more than 127,000 confirmed deaths. Non-essential shops have been allowed to reopen, along with hair salons, gyms, and outdoor services at pubs and restaurants. Some Britons continued to leave floral tributes to Prince Philip outside Buckingham Palace Sunday. This is despite authorities requesting them not to congregate in line with social distancing guidelines. Philip died on Friday at Windsor Castle, where he and Queen Elizabeth had resided throughout the coronavirus pandemic. Buckingham Palace said his funeral would be held on Saturday, April 17th, with long-established plans redrawn and scaled down because of COVID-19 restrictions. The prince will be given a ceremonial royal funeral rather than a state funeral. There will be no public processions, and it will be held entirely within the grounds of Windsor Castle and limited to 30 mourners. It was supposed to be a unifying weekend for a Republican Party at war with itself over former U.S. President Donald Trump's divisive leadership, but Trump himself shattered 2 days of relative peace in his closing remarks to the GOP's top donors when he insulted the party's Senate leader and his wife. Trump veered sharply from prepared remarks Saturday night and instead slammed Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell as a stone-cold loser and mocked McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who was Trump's transportation secretary. He also said he was disappointed in his Vice President Mike Pence and used a profanity in assessing McConnell, according to multiple people in attendance who were not authorized to publicly discuss what was said during a private session. Again, former President Donald Trump was speaking at a event for the Republican Party, a fundraising event, talking very negatively about the former colleagues. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting is underway in Sunday Benin election that the opposition says was poorly attended.
All over the country, people did not go out to vote. Even they are telling them to come and vote, but they didn't go and vote. But when they publish the results, then we see that they have 90% of votes.
They are also counting votes in Chad, where President Idriss Déby is expected to win a sixth term. South Sudan President reshuffles his government amid slow peace implementation. The fate of thousands of refugees in Kenya remains uncertain. And militants attack humanitarian aid facilities in Damasak, northern Nigeria.
These attacks on humanitarian organizations are senseless, and perpetrators should be held accountable. And we are really calling all actors, especially the government of Nigeria, to ensure that the humanitarian space is preserved.
And Liberia becomes the first African country to introduce the typhoid vaccine into routine immunization. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Is underway in Sunday Benin election that the opposition says was poorly attended. President Patrice Talon is seeking a second five-year term that the opposition says violates his pledge not to seek another term. Sadiko Ayo Alao is the president of GERDES Africa, a research group on democracy and economic and social development in Africa. From the Benin capital, Cotonou, he says the election was also marred by violence and irregularities.
People are not voting. But the result that we publish will be different because even in places where the voting pool are not open, they are saying that they have a lot of people, but the journalists, essentially the international press people, they saw that people did not go out. But as you know, the result will be positive for them.
I saw the cell phone videos and it showed that there was shooting, military shooting in the street. What can you tell us about the violence?
Yeah, they killed a lot of people yesterday because they could not transport the electoral material to some places, especially in the north. People are still demonstrating in the streets. Some of them have been killed, but demonstrators also have been arrested. More than 500 demonstrators have been arrested in various places, including Cotonou, Port Novo, and the northern region as well. But so far, we don't have exactly the number of people that have been killed.
President Patrice Talon said Sunday when he went to vote that there were people who have mobilized fighters to attack the republic. Police officers have been attacked with weapons of war. That's what he said.
Yeah, I just made the statement, but which is totally wrong. Because our constitution provided that they cannot give, order cannot be given by president to kill people or to shoot people. If there is no regulation adopted by the board of government and then approved by the parliament, but none of these things happen. People think that they are mercenaries that have been sent to assist the army. And because they were not speaking French and they don't speak any local language, and those people, mercenaries, start shooting with national local soldiers as well.
It was the opposition on Saturday that called for on its supporters not to turn out to vote. People say, well, why not go and vote? And maybe you might be able to defeat or beat President Talon.
Yeah, but even today, the voting booths are closing now. But most of the people, they don't have 10% of voters. All over the country, people did not go out to vote. Even they are calling them from house to come and vote. But they didn't go and vote. But when they publish the result, they will say that they have 90%, of course. When you don't have peace in mind and there is no peaceful environment, people will not go out to vote.
When would the results be released?
Normally in Benin, the result is published after maximum 5 days, but I'm sure they'll publish the result tonight or tomorrow morning saying that he won, he got 90%. Because they need to do it very quickly because we have no more power since about 5 days.
Sadiko Ayo Alao is the president of GERDES Africa, a research group on democracy and economic and social development in Africa. You are speaking with us from the Benin capital, Cotonou. Votes are also being counted from Sunday's election in Chad, where President Idriss Déby is expected to win a sixth term. Déby, in power for 30 years, is expected to win re-election because critics say he has intimidated and jailed his main challengers. Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of former President Issen Habre's crimes. He says many Chadians chose to stay home because they don't believe that Sunday's election represents democracy, especially after 30 years of President Déby rule.
The election is not free, and people were afraid because everywhere you can saw militaries and the vehicle of militaries going around, and the people were afraid too. Some didn't find their name or didn't collect their election card, and the most of them don't believe on this election is taking place today.
In addition to President Déby, who are some of the candidates that are running against him?
I was told that most of them, you know, the question of the election system is not going from them. And they are not, you know, as I said, they're not in our country, they're not considering as opposition. There's no opposition. The real opposition take off, and they just scored him, let me say that, because of the issue of the election or the democracy. Just call them and organize them for this election.
Clement, what can you tell us about this announcement that was made by the Interior Minister saying that the government arrested at least several people, including some of politicians, after it discovered a plot to assassinate prominent political figures? Who are those arrested, and how true is this allegation?
I cannot argue because now I'm at home, I'm sick, and I read and I hear you, so I don't have some element to argue.
So you said that the turnout was very poor.
Very, very poor.
Why do you suppose the people did not turn out?
Because, you know, they didn't believe or they don't believe in the ruling of the country or the gestion of the country. Because after 30 years, the same kind of ruling the nation. And, you know, you cannot get medicine, you cannot schooling, you cannot grow your teeth. You cannot have water, you cannot have electricity. So I think that all of the wealth of the country is not going for the development of the country.
Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of former President Issen Habre's crimes. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. The United Nations has condemned terrorist attacks against humanitarian aid facilities in the town of Damasak in the northern Nigerian state of Borno on Saturday and Sunday. The Nigerian military said the terrorists looted humanitarian offices and killed two unidentified men. Tom Pere Costa is spokesperson for West and Central Africa with the Norwegian Refugee Council. He said the attackers set their guest house ablaze and destroyed life-saving relief supplies, including aid delivery vehicles.
What I can tell you is that yesterday, around 4:30 p.m., armed men launched a full-scale attack on the town of Damasak. And several humanitarian organizations suffered heavy destructions. We, NRC, have seen our guest house destroyed, burned down to the ground. There is nothing left. Our vehicles were burned as well. The house was looted. And several organizations were affected by this. And also, and what's really concerning is that the common warehouse where several humanitarian actors store their stock, the food, the material for humanitarian support, this warehouse was looted and destroyed as well. So we don't know really what is the situation of our stock, but we expect the worst.
What kind of work exactly does your organization do in that part of Nigeria?
NRC works a bit everywhere in northeast Nigeria, in Borno State. But especially, specifically in Damasak, we provide water and sanitation support. We provide clean and drinkable water for the displaced people. We also support them by providing shelter, so they have a place where to stay. We provide legal assistance and offer livelihood opportunities as well. But what we also do when there are absolute emergencies is what we call rapid response, basically taking care of the new waves of displaced people.
Northeast Nigeria has been a volatile area in Nigeria, particularly because of the activities of, say, Boko Haram and other militants. Does your organization know exactly who might have attacked your facilities?
We don't have precise information about the perpetrators of the attacks. There are reports online mentioning ISWAP. But what is important to understand is that no matter who's attacking, the international community, the donors and the government really need to make sure that humanitarians are able to deliver. Otherwise, we will not be able to support the large displaced population. These attacks on humanitarian organizations are senseless, and perpetrators should be held accountable. And we are really calling all actors, especially the government of Nigeria, to ensure that the humanitarian space is preserved and that the populations are protected as well.
Tom Pere-Costa is the spokesperson for Western Central Africa with the Norwegian Refugee Council. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 12. The fate of hundreds of thousands of refugees in Kenya hangs in the balance as UN officials try to dissuade Kenyan authorities from closing two camps that many have called home for the past three decades. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Kenyan government announced its intention to close the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps on March 24th. It gave the UN Refugee Agency 2 weeks to come up with a roadmap for returning home the 430,000 residents of the two sprawling camps. Most come from Somalia. That deadline was up Thursday. However, the refugees and the UNHCR have been given a last-minute reprieve. News organizations and activists report Kenya's High Court on Thursday suspended the government's closure order for 30 days. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says his agency is deeply concerned about the impact Kenya's closure of the camps would have on the needs of the refugees, including their need for protection from the COVID-19 pandemic.
We are in constant dialogue with the authorities on the issue and have been urging them to ensure that any decisions allow for suitable and sustainable solutions to be found, and that those who continue to need protection as refugees are able to receive it in line with Kenya's national and international obligations.
Baluch says a statement issued by the UNHCR's office in Nairobi recognizes the generosity extended by the people and government of Kenya towards the refugees for many decades.
The statement says that UNHCR has shared with the government of Kenya a proposed set of sustainable and right-based measures aimed at identifying solutions for refugees living in the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps. We have heard the concerns expressed by the government of Kenya and hope that these measures will be a significant step forward in accelerating, as I mentioned, sustainable solutions for all those concerned.
The UNHCR's plan includes a provision for increasing the voluntary repatriation of refugees, taking into account restrictions imposed because of COVID-19. It proposes that some refugees from East Africa be allowed to remain in Kenya and become self-reliant and contributing members of society. The plan also calls for the resettlement to third countries of refugees who would run life-threatening risks were they to be returned to their countries of origin. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir over the weekend made changes to his government. Presidential spokesperson Atain Wek Atain says the changes were normal and included the appointment of a new army chief.
Well, it was a mini reshuffle that has affected the former Minister of Presidential Affairs, Honorable Nyaal Deng Nyaal. and affected the former deputy minister for defense and veteran affairs, General Malik Rubin, and also it has affected the reorganization of the staff council, which has affected the former chief of defense forces, General Johnson Umaukot, who was replaced by his deputy for administration and finance, General Santino Dengwon. The chief of defense force was actually made ambassador of South Sudan to Brussels, and the former deputy minister of defense was also appointed the ambassador of South Sudan to Eritrea, and the former GIB, which is the external service branch, was appointed also the ambassador of South Sudan to the state of Kuwait.
Of course, given the combination of the South Sudan government, one will always be interested in knowing whether these changes were done in consultation with your first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar.
No, there is nothing that requires consultation with the first vice president in this regard, simply because the president, on reshuffling the proportions that is given to his part of the agreement, he does not need to consult with anyone. He can consult within his portions, which he did sufficiently. Only if the affected person is from the SPLM-IO, that requires Dr. Machar to agree on. But this is about the portions that is led by President Salva Kiir. He does not need to consult with the first vice president. Also, the army, which was reshuffled yesterday, is still not the unified one because the security sector has not been unified.
You know, it's been years since the government was formed. Still, you are still talking about the factions of the government belonging to Dr. Riek Machar and the faction of the government belonging to President Salva Kiir. The revitalized peace agreement was in 2018. Is it going to take a decade now, 10 more years, before you people completely approve the agreement?
No, there has been a slow phase of the implementation, but the agreement was given 36 months, which has been running behind, and we are left with few months according to the date the agreement was signed on the 12th of September 2018, which by 12th of September 2019, the 3 years would have elapsed, but because of the slow implementation, we are not expected to go to election after September or before September because of the difficulties that are attached to and even the practical aspect of it. So we are expecting the elections to happen, you know, afterwards. It is the parties to agree on the appropriate dates and the appropriate year, but it will not go for a decade because the political problem in South Sudan are so deeply rooted to the extent that if there is no free and fair elections held between 22 and 2023, South Sudanese will not be able to have any other legitimacy to hang on.
Atain Wek Atain is a spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. Liberia has become the first African country to introduce the typhoid vaccine into routine immunizations. The vaccine was introduced to children during a five-day nationwide campaign. In 2019, Liberia had 5,836 typhoid cases. Adolphus Clark, Liberia's Expanded Program on Immunization Manager, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the benefits to rolling out the vaccine and the challenges of doing so during another pandemic.
The fact that the vaccine has been launched, this is another milestone in the fight of reducing the morbidity and mortality of vaccine-preventable diseases in Liberia.
How did the vaccine rollout go? Was it well received? And, you know, where do you go from here?
We are across the 15 countries. We know that the uptake is something that we are working on because we are administering the vaccine at the time where there has been mis- and disinformation about vaccination relative to the most recent situation about the COVID-19 vaccine in Europe. And so there's a little bit of apprehension, but we are working with our communication team to ensure that we can intensify our community engagement efforts and continue to sensitize and educate our people that there's a difference between the type of vaccine and that of the COVID vaccine. More so, the target groupings, they are not the same. For COVAX or the COVID-19 vaccine, we are looking at people 18 years and above. For typhoid, we're looking at children 9 months to 14 years. So we are beginning to see uptake increasing by the day. But we look forward to see how we can do more to accelerate that.
Is skepticism around the COVID-19 vaccine impeding some of the efforts to roll out the typhoid vaccine then?
I see it as an opportunity that it has revealed to us as a country to be able to engage our people more. Yes, one would call it a challenge, but for me, I see it as an opportunity because what that tells me is that we need to do more community engagement. We need to interact with our people at the local level more and help in addressing or allaying the fears. So I wouldn't want to view it from the angle as a challenge. I think it's an opportunity. We just need to cultivate that opportunity.
So you mentioned working at a local level more. Can you tell me kind of some specific examples of what you think that might look like in Liberia?
Hesitancy or refusal or non-compliance is not pronounced in Liberia, but it's also, you cannot erase the fact that people are skeptical or have some semblance of fear relative to making decisions on whether to allow their child or children get vaccinated, especially in the midst of administering a COVID-19 vaccine. Like I said earlier, this is an opportunity. We need to speak to our people more. We need to engage them more because if we don't do so, then we allow mis- and disinformation to thrive for a very long time period, and that could further injure or hurt the immunization program. So
that was Adolphus Clark, Liberia's expanded program on immunization manager. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Monrovia. Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with results for match day 4 of the CAF Confederations Cup. South African side Orlando Pirates dominated Libyan outfit Al Ahly Benghazi, winning by a 3-0 scoreline on Sunday to move to 8 points in Group A of the Total CAF Confederations Cup. Orlando Pirates coach Joseph Zimbauer seems to be getting cautiously optimistic about the possibility of his side challenging for continental silverware in the CAF Confederations Cup.
We are happy about this. This is the things what we want and what we see as a trainer. We are happy about the attackers.
In Group B, Cameroon's Cotton Sport consolidated their grip on the 2020-2021 CAF Confederations Cup Group B top spot, thrashing NAPSA Stars 5-1 in Garoua on Sunday afternoon. Cotton Sport raised their tally to 9 points on top of Group B, 4 more than their closest rivals Algeria's JS Kabylie and 5 more than holders RS Bakane of Morocco, while NAPSA Stars remain bottom with a lone point. Soleimani Abubakar, the Cotton Sports head coach, was full of praises for his players.
Now we are playing at home. We are playing at home. Morally, we are free. We are free. That's why the players expressed themselves without difficulties.
Mohamed Fathi, NAPSA Stars coach, blamed the defeat on the injuries picked up by some of his players before the game.
But also, we create a lot of chances. Our players, I think that the experience played a big role on this game. But I think our players, we have our backlift is injured from the first game. And also, we have some setback.
Meanwhile, in a Group C match, home side Sfaxien came from 2 goals down, equalizing with a 93rd-minute penalty to force a 2-2 draw with fellow Tunisian side Etoile du Sahel, while Zambia's other representative, Nkana, revived their Group D qualification hopes, completing the double over Tanzania's Namungo 1-0 in Ndola. In the CAF Champions League, all 8 teams for the quarterfinal stage of the competitions have emerged following the conclusion of the group stage of the 2020-2021 CAF Champions League on Saturday. Algerian side MC Alger and South African side Kaizer Chiefs were the final 2 sides to secure quarterfinal berths, while Egyptian side and last season's beaten finalists Zamalek crashed out. Others who had earlier booked their place in the last 8 include Simba SC of Tanzania, Al Ahly of Egypt, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa, CR Belouizdad, Wydad Athletic Club, and Esperance de Tunis. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, April 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butter in Washington, wishing you a great week.